Some ideas are not worth being nice to.
Hate speech laws, for example, have absolutely nothing to do with your intentions and everything to do with how it's perceived.
There was the Islamic Golden Age, and it backslid into a dark age that is still happening today.
Like, if everyone was okay with you burning Bibles, you wouldn't need to go burn them.
Philosophers.
So what are we talking about today, David?
This might end up being, like, multiculturalism part two.
Fair enough.
I don't know if that's a worthy title. We'll probably end up going somewhere a little different than that, because we're not going to get into definitions of multiculturalism. But this is a strong parallel anyway. Basically, I think this started from musing slash being horrified by happenings in across the pond.
Mm-hmm.
In which the secular societies, or at least that are ostensibly secular in Europe, are now considering blasphemy laws on account of certain protests that happened that upset certain demographics, religious demographics. So I think the topic is a discussion about, okay, how has that culture, the European culture, dug its own grave in this case, I guess? And where do you need to draw the line to, like, protect secular values and things like that, I guess, is kind of the starting place.
Sure. And I guess before we get too far into that, we, of course, don't mean all of Europe, naturally. Yeah. But there is there's an interesting pattern. It's actually a fairly linear disbursement of how secular countries in Europe are.
Mm-hmm.
Let me rank it this way. I'm looking at this some data based on a survey done in 2008-09 throughout Europe by Gallup, asking people how important religion was. And typically, secular folks don't find religion to be very important. Duh.
Well, yeah.
That's not to say that the person may not identify with some kind of religion or have some type of religion that, you know, you can be a nominal religious person, meaning that you would call yourself, oh, well, I'm a Catholics are like the ones that I think of that are like the most common. Oh, I'm Catholic, but they don't observe very many Catholic rituals. They're Easter Catholics, we'll say.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they show up to church once a year. They may identify as Catholic, but they would also vote in this poll that religion is not that important to them. So that's kind of my barometer by how I'm measuring secularism, I guess, for the sake of how things are changing. And the elite, the country that had the least importance of religion was Estonia, with 16% of the population said that religion was important.
Interesting. I'm surprised it wasn't France.
We're
like actively anti-religious right now.
France is 30%.
Really?
A little way up the list. Well, I'll just read them up for a little. I'll read like the 10 top 10 least religious in order from least religious, mm-hmm, or least important finding religion, uh-huh, and to most. So the top 10 from, like, Estonia being the least up is Sweden, Denmark, Norway, the Czech Republic, the United Kingdom, Finland, and then France. Just that gets you to 30%. Then on the other end of the spectrum, going down to 70%, everyone else will fall kind of, mm-hmm, somewhere in the middle. The country, there's a tie at 90% where the 90% of the population said that religion was important, and that's between Kosovo and Georgia. And then up from there, it's Armenia, Moldova, Malta, Turkey, Bosnia and Herzegovina. I'm sorry, it's Bosnia. Sorry, Bosnia slash whatever. And you know, Romania, Cyprus, Poland.
Yeah, so East Europe. Yeah.
Well, Italy, Portugal, Greece.
Yeah,
central to east-ish, we'll say.
And that checks out. Yeah.
Well, and then you get to but Russia is only 34%, and so is Belarus. So it's kind of all over the place. That being said, though, it's a smattering of countries that don't find religion to be that important.
So I guess when I used the word secular, I didn't mean like the concentration of the population that thinks religion is important. I'm talking about like valuing a secular government that doesn't pick sides and doesn't treat religious institutions specially.
Sure. Yeah, I think that these things are related. If you do not think that religion is all that important, you probably don't want it to have a fundamental factor in your government.
Probably.
You also don't think that it's worth creating legislation to protect.
Right.
You know.
But I think the thing... Okay. So the particular incident that happened that has sparked this conversation, I forget which country this was in. Somewhere in Northeast Europe, I think. Somebody in protest burned a copy of the Quran, right? And it was their own copy. They bought it, paid for it themselves, and burned it, which in any secular society should be acknowledged as an instance of free expression. They are protesting. They are trying to send a message. But naturally, the religion of butthurt, and I will leave that in there.
Yep.
Can't handle it. Can't handle a little free expression. And, they start throwing a fit, across the world about that this has been allowed to happen. And now all of the guilty natives of this country and surrounding countries, are considering that, oh, well, maybe we shouldn't allow that to happen because it makes these people so upset. That is where I'm coming from here, that it's not even a matter of, oh, we think religion is important and you shouldn't be allowed to disrespect religion like that. It's like, no, this group of people is becoming a nuisance with how upset they are, and we're going to appease them by taking away your freedom.
Yeah. So just to give you a little bit more specifics, there were several incidences, and it was in Sweden that particularly kicked this off.
I knew it was somewhere up there, yeah.
By far not the only country who... has had this kind of thing happen, but yeah. What I also find interesting about this, so most of these European countries historically have had blasphemy laws. Well, the fun thing about blasphemy laws is they kind of only matter for the institution you care about,
mm-hmm.
or the attached religion to the state.
The state religion, yeah.
For example, now granted, we all know that laws take a while to catch up with the people. But, for example, like Iceland and Norway abolished their blasphemy laws in 2015. They finally got around to it. While the Netherlands did it in 2012. And only in 2020 has the European Parliament really started to condemn blasphemy laws existing. All while some of the largest members, for example, like Italy, Germany, Poland and Finland all still actively have blasphemy laws on books. So I think there's a decent... What's interesting about it is I think it's easy to get lost in the sauce on this where people, you know, of the different religious groups will argue both in favor and against blasphemy laws depending on who is it going to get applied to, right? And that's not what we're talking about. I mean, that's the petty squabble that every religious group has had since the dawn of time. And ultimately, one of the biggest reasons I think that gave rise to secularism is the fact that there's just so many religions out there that have been killing each other for thousands of years that it becomes very clear to some people that none of these probably have the right answer. Right? Because mm-hmm. if one of them was actually right and had a god backing it, you would have thought...
They would probably have taken over the world. Yeah.
Exactly. I think it would be a lot harder to be a secularist in a world in which there is only one, like, or a single religion dominated, like, even 50% of the planet, mm-hmm. which we don't have. You know? So, I would like to say, finally, we can put one in the book. I am very happy to live in a country that does not have blasphemy laws at all.
Yeah, it is illegal to have one.
Right.
The First Amendment.
Literally. And I think that's also interesting because people, like, when I was looking at articles for this, it was a bunch of articles about should Europe have blasphemy laws, should Europe repeal their blasphemy laws, should Europe add blasphemy laws, and then like a random article of why is Europe so much more secular than America,
except it isn't.
It isn't like, at all.
In law, it is not.
Right. So maybe that goes to the point you were trying to make.
I think, yeah, it's that, yeah, European culture, I think, is largely more secular than American culture. I think that this is a topic for a different day, perhaps, that America has lost its way in its secular values. Although, I mean, what do you expect from a country that was founded by the people who were so obnoxiously religious that they fled their home country and came over here to establish their own religious states?
Right.
Because
well,
that those fled. Are the people, those are the people who founded America.
Yeah, fled's an interesting word there. I mean, kicked out in a lot of places, I feel like I've had some very interesting.
They were rejected.
Yes, like the
Puritans. Yes. Let's talk about the Puritans.
Let's talk about the I want to talk about three specific groups of people, I guess. Well, okay. Maybe just two. The Puritans and the Anabaptists. Mm-hmm. Those are the two interesting cases to me. We'll do the Puritans first. So,
yeah.
Tell us about the Puritans, David.
The Puritans, they thought that people were not practicing a pure enough religion. They didn't like all the rituals and symbols and things like that. You know, that's idol worship. It needs to just be between you and Jesus. But we also need the local government to help people stay pure. So, and the people around them were like, nah, we don't really feel like it. And they were like, well, I'm tired of this. And they stomped their feet and got on a ship and went across an ocean so that they could actually do it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So they fled TM or were like rejected. Anabaptists were interesting. I'm gonna pull up an article here. So the Anabaptists in like, I think particularly in Denmark, I think it's Denmark. That's where Amsterdam is, right?
No.
Where is that?
The Netherlands.
The Netherlands. That's the one I was trying to remember. Sorry, Denmark and the Netherlands. This group of people fled from other countries because they took their crap so seriously that they were like burning stuff over it. And then they were gathered up there with a group of more tolerant people who even were like, oh my God, y'all are the worst. And they just shipped them overseas. Yeah. I think the reason I thought that is because it was the Dutch who supplied a lot of the ships at the time to like do that. But it's in modern day. Anyway, not important. But yeah, so there were actually like radical reformist Christians who were getting just thrown on boats and shipped across the sea because they were just too rowdy about it. Which is kind of funny when you think about who the Anabaptists are today. Mennonites and the Amish being rowdy about it. Like, but take them the way they are now, being as radical as they are in their lifestyle, but add some violence to it. And mm-hmm. That's what you had in the day. And I think maybe Quakers being as peaceful as they are, it's weird to think about them being kind of like that, but Quakers even then were also like just ornery. Like they just wouldn't get with the program with anyone else because they're so stuck up in the way they believe what they do, which mm-hmm. I mean, you know, they have the courage of their convictions, I suppose, but still. But yeah, with all those groups, it's still kind of funny that we were all like, yeah, but none of you can actually tell anyone else what to do. We're not going to have this whole state religion thing.
Well, they definitely still had state religions at the time, but the state religion wasn't going to take itself that seriously. That was the difference. I would still not call those secular societies.
No. I feel like we are all over the place with this episode already, but
it's okay.
We're
returning to form.
Good.
Utter chaos.
And
tangents.
But yeah, it is shocking to me to think that there are people who are like, you know what? Maybe a blasphemy law is a good idea. You know, like let's talk about it. And that's a little ludicrous that it's even on the table to me. Like,
yeah, it is literally foreign to me.
Yeah. So I guess we should do a little bit more due diligence and explain what a blasphemy law is.
Law against disrespecting a religion,
yeah.
Essentially.
Yeah, I was going to read from the Wikipedia to give a little bit more specificity, but a blasphemy law is a law prohibiting blasphemy, naturally, which is the act of insulting or showing contempt or lack of reverence to a deity or sacred objects or towards something considered sacred or inviolable. So yeah, that's...
Yeah, hurting the wrong feelings.
The wrong feelings.
That's what it is.
Mm-hmm. The punishments for such laws also usually get real extreme really fast. Like, looking at a map of the world, starting at no blasphemy laws to their repeal to subnational restrictions to fines and restrictions, jumping straight to prison, then death sentences. There are more than 10 countries in the world that still will just absolutely kill you if you hurt the wrong feelings, and then a shockingly high number of more that will actually just straight up put you in prison, which is wild.
Mm-hmm.
It's like, oh, so what you think about our new church steeple? I think it's dumb. Kill him. No, what?
Stoned to death.
Stoned. Yeah, it's always barbaric ways of death too. Thrown from rooftops, burned, stoned. Awful. So,
very peaceful people.
Religions of peace and all. I feel like I'm going to just throw this out. I think the reason this is being considered is because we let something else on the table, and Europe specifically has had something on the table like this for a long time. The other kind of hurt feelings laws, offense laws in general.
Mm-hmm.
Which, again, not something we have in the United States.
No.
You can say...
Yeah, the law does not care about your feelings, actually.
Right. You can actually say any combination of words in the right context in the United States.
The closest you can get to that is, like, disturbing the peace, right?
Sure.
Or harassment. Things like that.
Yeah. Which, I think... Okay.
But those are neutral to the content of what you're doing.
Exactly. It's about right.
How you're targeting and causing a particular person emotional distress, you know, when it comes to harassment.
When it comes to harassment, yeah. So I know this may sound routine,
but it has
nothing
to do with what you're saying. It's how you're doing it. Yeah.
Exactly. I think it's actually worth going into what these even mean. So, like, because I know a lot of people will say, well, so you support harassment because you think people can say whatever they want. No, I don't.
No, I don't.
But there's a huge difference, and then you just kind of said it. But, like, I should be able to go outside, sit on my front porch, and just start talking into the air, and I should be able to say literally whatever I want in just a neutral tone. The moment I get up and start following you around and saying the same thing over and over and over and over and over and over and over again, and not
letting you
go.
Even though I keep telling you to shut up and go away.
Right.
Yeah.
It's like verbal trespassing.
Right.
And it kind of only works in your immediate vicinity. And I think this is where it gets weird about the internet, because where is your immediate vicinity on the internet? Wherever you look.
But it would be acceptable for you to go into a public place like a park or something like that, stand up on a soapbox and start shouting these things at everyone indiscriminately. Sure. Because now you're protesting, right?
Right.
You're delivering a speech, which is totally protected. You're not harassing any particular... If anybody doesn't want to hear you, they can leave.
Right. Now, you may run up against the other thing we had talked about before, which is disturbing the peace, which is a terribly named thing, by the way, for what it actually means. So I guess let's go into...
Or disorderly conduct, as it is sometimes also called, but it's essentially the same thing. Depends on where you go.
Yeah. So I'm going to try to... We're not... Also, by the way, none of this is legal advice, but...
Yeah, we're not lawyers, and even if we were, we're not your lawyer.
Right.
So please talk to a lawyer before deciding to exercise your rights, I guess.
So I'm just going to read an example of a legal statute for what it means to perform disorderly conduct. Okay. Which, by the way, disturbing the peace, disorderly conduct.
It's
literally the same thing. So it means a person commits the offense of disorderly conduct if with the purpose to cause public inconvenience, annoyance, or alarm, or recklessly creating a risk of public inconvenience, annoyance, or alarm, if he or she, one, engages in fighting or in violent, threatening, or tumultuous behavior, two, makes unreasonable or excessive noise, three, in a public place uses abusive or obscene language or makes an obscene gesture in a manner likely to provoke a violent or disorderly response. Four, disrupts or disturbs any lawful assembly or meeting of persons. Five, obstructs vehicular or pedestrian traffic. Six, congregates with two or more persons in a public place and refuses to comply with a lawful order to disperse of a law enforcement officer or other person engaged in enforcing or executing the law. Seven, creates a hazardous or physically offensive condition, which is, that's a weird thing. Eight,
i.e., like bad smells and things like that.
Yeah. Wow.
Or like releasing smoke clouds, things like that.
Right.
Burning stuff.
Eight, in a public place, mars, defiles, desecrates, or otherwise damages a patriotic or religious symbol that is an object of respect by the public or substantial segment of the public.
Ooh.
Yeah. Or nine, in a public space, exposes his or her private parts.
Hmm.
Flashing, essentially.
Right.
Now, that's a lot of things. One of those sounds remarkably close to a blasphemy law.
Yes. But it's not.
It's not.
Because I can still grab my own Bible.
Yes.
And go burn it.
Correct.
Yeah.
Yeah, I can't defile some public, like, someone else's right, thing.
Because it's not mine, first of all. Like, that's the number one reason why you shouldn't even be able to do that. Although it shouldn't be under disorderly conduct. It should be under vandalism.
Well, I don't know. Let me reread that
but
to you.
But it sounds like there's other stuff that qualifies as vandalism here, and they've just kind of wrapped it up into the same thing.
Well, I mean, let me reread it to you. In a public place, mars, defiles, desecrates, or otherwise damages a patriotic or religious symbol
mm-hmm.
that is an object of respect by the public or substantial segment of the public. It's just the symbol you have to defile. It can be your...
I feel like this needs to refer to like a specific physical object and not... I realize it's written that way.
Yeah. I mean,
you're going to have a hard time in court.
Yeah. Well, this is also where you get into the pesky thing about the American legal system. Precedent, please.
Mm-hmm.
Precedent has argued more than once that if it's your property, you can do whatever you want with it. I think here it's more of a...
Right. The main problem that I would see getting arrested for burning a Bible in public for is that you're literally lighting things on fire in public that's dangerous.
Yeah. But if you're at a campground that has a campfire site, you light a fire in it and you throw a Bible into it that's yours...
Totally allowed.
So all this is a lot of things, but in general, the themes I think here are you are on purpose trying to rile people up. You're trying to start crap. If your intent there is just to display information or just speak, most of these other things fall apart based on the original conditions offered. Because all of those things I said below are examples of behavior, but those examples of behavior have to have the purpose to cause public inconvenience, annoyance, or alarm. So if I go out there and I want to talk about how we should return to monkey, and I do so purely for the purpose of making people upset, that's actually what disorderly conduct or disturbing the peace is. Mm-hmm. But if I actually believe that, and I actually think that I would be helping the people by saying that,
no, you're protected under the First Amendment.
Yep.
You're freely expressing your opinion.
Yep. And even if people think that I'm just doing this to be a jerk, the worst case...
Prove it. You have to prove that, though.
You have to prove it, but B, even if you do prove it, the penalty is like a $400 fine.
Mm-hmm.
And that's it. Like,
well, the other penalty is you'll be arrested, right?
Well, sure, it's inconvenient, but...
Right.
It's a lot of things that are inconvenient.
But it means that you will be suppressed in that moment.
In that moment, yes.
Yeah.
But you will not be harshly punished.
Yeah, you're not going to prison. Yeah.
Right. So the way this is, I think, different with how people view offense these days is that it doesn't actually matter. The intention does not matter. Like, what I'm saying matters more than either how I'm saying it or in the context in which I'm saying it. By that, I mean either what I want to invoke in another person, that matters, how I'm doing it, am I following you, borderline stalking you, but also talking while doing it, you know, those are still crimes, but it has nothing to do with the content of what I'm saying. Whereas offense laws are laws that have to do with the content of, like, hate speech laws, for example, have absolutely nothing to do with your intentions and everything to do with how it's perceived,
mm-hmm.
which... Again, in the moment, it's both, realistically. Like, if I were to say something to you, if in the moment you believe that I am trying to do that, you could still call the police and maybe have me arrested. Mm-hmm. What matters, though, is
the proving is going to have to happen in court, which requires other processes first.
Sure. And that's really where a lot of this matters, is if I get drug into a court, you know, what's going to happen to me? Like, am I afforded the benefit of knowing that anything that I did say matters zero for, and it has all about you having to prove that I had these intentions,
mm-hmm.
you know, versus it's on display for the whole court and a person sits up there and decides whether what I said was truly offense or not, or even worse, that it is a true fact that the person who's putting me in here, the person who called the police on me, proving that they were actually offended, which means that I can be held liable for the weak will of someone else,
mm-hmm.
you know, and that's the key issue. And I think that is why blasphemy laws are being entertained, because all it is an extension of this feeling of offense,
mm-hmm.
as a law, which I think is insane.
Yeah, this behavior hurts a certain demographic's feelings, so we're going to make it illegal.
Right. So it's a little bit of both. It's one, creating a protected class of people that is special, people of the religious kind.
Mm-hmm.
But also, it is leaving you at the mercy of how other people interpret what you do, which by the way, you are anyway, right? I'm not
going to
pretend
people are going to judge you. Yeah,
sure. But they shouldn't. But they should have to judge me. They shouldn't have me drug in front of
the
actual
law
judge.
Has no business judging me about this. Yeah,
right. And the key operating difference between the word judge in both of those cases, one is just your opinion, like, man, and the other
one has actual consequences.
Right. Like, yeah. They're called judges because, and that's an old term that essentially means that they are the deciders of life and death, ultimately. And their opinion, and it
actually matters. Yeah.
And especially in an official capacity. So I think that's why these are even being considered again. And I think that both are cancerous on society, and we should get rid of both. Well, I say that. I think Europe should go ahead and get rid of both. And in America, we should just not. Like, let's not make that mistake. And it is kind of shocking to see how many people are kind of mulling the idea over, like there's some good of it. And I think my question would be is, what good comes from these laws, right?
It's the same thing as the disorderly conduct thing, right? It's all about, now, okay, again, there are things like harassment that I think should be illegal, but a lot of it is, there is so much wrapped up in stuff like disorderly conduct that is just like, what do we have to make illegal to keep people quiet, keep people from complaining to the police all the time that people are up to stuff?
Yeah.
So, yeah, it's like, what do we have to do to make this? What do we have to do to make these loud people shut up? That's what it's about.
But why does it matter?
Why does it matter to whom?
Like, exactly. That's my point. Like, who are you to say?
The authorities are to say, because they're tired of being bothered by the yelling people.
Well, that's not my problem. Don't be the authorities.
It is your problem because they have the authority to make it your problem. That's the problem.
Right. But the thing I have about it is that, okay, I see the benefit from their perspective, but the authorities are not the ones who should be making the laws, ideally. And even in most parliamentary systems, it should not be that the government makes the laws necessarily. It should be that the representatives of the people make the laws.
Yeah.
Which are the government. I get that. But they should have the people's interest in mind. You know, and I don't know. I feel like the only good argument that I've heard for this, that I, again, don't even think is a good argument, is that this is just a natural extension of a community of people expressing their will and trying to uphold their values. And they want to create a space in which their values can be protected, i.e. their cultural identity. And I think the biggest examples of people who actually bring this to the government and actually act on it all the time is French Canada.
Mm-hmm.
They talk about a group of people who tries so hard to be France 2.0, even though they're France,
but compensating.
Yes. They go to extreme. So if you're interested in this, I guess this is the moment in the episode where we throw out a sponsor that isn't even a sponsor that we just like. But JJ McCullough on YouTube.
Yes.
He does a great job, I think, of he's Canadian and he
our
does
favorite
a,
Canadian.
Second favorite Canadian to me.
Who's first favorite?
Niall Redd.
Okay, yeah, that's fair. He's pretty cool.
He is pretty cool. Second favorite Canadian to me, at least. He does a lot about American politics, which to him means North American politics, even though he doesn't talk a whole lot about Mexico, but that's okay, JJ, I get it. It's hard to remember that they're also a part of North America. But he mainly means like Canada and the U.S. But being Canadian himself, he particularly will discuss Canadian issues and how they fit in the broader American zeitgeist. Mm-hmm. And some of his content is about how weird French Canada is, or Quebec is, or Quebecers, or the Quebecois, or whatever they want to call themselves. Mm-hmm. This is a group of people that has so much gusto about it that they're the reason that literally everywhere in France, not just in the particular province in which they preside, everything has to be in two languages. Like, if you've ever, and you may not have, but if you ever do consume any media or see a news report coming from a French TV station or see their parliamentary proceedings or just see signs of places in Canada, both are on almost everything. It's English. In the predominantly English-speaking parts, it's English in big bold letters and then small italics in French underneath. And then in Quebec, it's inverted, you know. But that's how hard they work to ensure that they are passing laws and advocating laws be passed to protect their community of the Frenchness of Quebec. And on the one hand, I get it. If I had and lived in a community that upheld certain values, right, I, too, would probably take actions of my own accord to try to preserve that community. Like I'm literally doing right now, living in a community, broadly speaking, or a nation that doesn't have blasphemy laws, I am actively advocating that we don't do it. I'm trying to protect the culture as it exists now, as it manifests itself, I guess, in the legal system. So I do get that. But at the same time, I think if we were to argue about which is more important, I would err on the side that tolerance and not doing something is better than letting one group do something to someone else. And when I say that, I mean backed by the government or backed by the force, the monopoly on force, you know. In fact, I think a lot of the things I always advocate for is if we cannot come to any consensus, it is much, much better to err on the side of not doing anything than it is of acting that would, in a way, that would benefit one over the other, mm-hmm. you know? So, like, what are your thoughts on that? Like, should countries be able to do that? Or, like, at what level should, like how would you see that working out, like, in the United States? Like, say, for example, one state in particular. Like, I'm trying to think, like, Maryland, that's a very Catholic state, puts in Catholic blasphemy laws only in Maryland, though, because they think that's important. That's better than the United States federally creating blasphemy laws. Mm-hmm. And I could still see why you wouldn't like it and think it was a bad idea. But does the weight of, well, it's them doing it for them, offset that at all for you? Or is it still just morally wrong to have blasphemy laws, do you think?
I think it is morally wrong to suppress ideas just because you don't like them. And that's what blasphemy laws serve to do. Mm-hmm. They serve to punish, usually harshly, those who speak against the popular opinion and therefore cement that religious idea in the culture in a way that it is very risky to try to subvert.
Yeah. Interesting. But if this were to happen, you can think that as a non-citizen of Maryland, which, mm-hmm. you know... because I would think that the people there would argue that it is morally wrong to allow the things that
they would, right?
Right. And so, I mean, our whole thing is morality is subjective, mm-hmm. right? So in acknowledgement of that, you know, we shouldn't necessarily put those things on the table, I guess, as far as like imposing our moral outcomes on other people.
Okay.
Right. I don't know. Like, It's hard because I feel like I'm at a perpetual disadvantage sometimes with people who are religious because they don't think that morality is subjective.
Mm-hmm.
Like to them, it's perfectly objective.
Well, that's what I kind of mean about Europe, but I guess also kind of largely Western culture digs its own grave like this, like where we want to be nice to all the other cultures, even when they are fundamentally incompatible with ours. And I know this sounds like a, you know, conservative xenophobic thing to say. But I mean, yeah, we act so guilty about how we have treated other cultures in the past that to the point that we will let backwards thinking people walk all over us, to get their way because we just want to be nice. And it's like some ideas are not worth being nice to.
Yeah. I mean, I agree. And then, yeah, it does sound like, oh God, Thanksgiving's coming early. And my uncle's already here, you know? But I do agree.
You know, and you know, that's not to say that I don't think people should be able to think those things. But I think, yeah, when you want to impose your ideas on other people and you're prepared to use the long arm of the law to stop people from challenging your beliefs. Yeah, I consider that political violence.
Yeah.
And religious violence. And that's a problem.
Yeah. And I think, you know, I find that when I'm discussing it with people who are entertaining the idea, one of the best things I can always say about it is, I'm advocating to allow them to talk about having these things, whereas they would not even, if I were in a country that had these things, I would be killed potentially for even suggesting we don't have them.
Yeah, that's the thing, right? Like you have these countries I'm talking specifically about in the Middle East where they take this stuff really seriously.
Sure.
Yeah, they're on the books because there were enough people who agreed about the religion in power and said, we're going to institute blasphemy laws. And now, even if they were to shift their system of government to be more democratic, and stand a reasonable chance of having the critical mass needed to repeal those laws, the first person who speaks up about it is going to be killed because they even suggested it.
Right.
Because it is still on the books. You can't challenge it so long as it is still on the books. So it's just there forever unless there is actually a revolution to throw them all out and start over.
Which again is rock bottom for any civilization.
Right. And we're trying not to do that. Yeah.
Yeah. No, I think that's a good point. I think that the new moral stance I could take is in line with that. I could actually argue from that point of like this.
It's an event horizon. There's no going back.
There's no going back. And not only that, but this is something that while it may be voted in by the majority, it could be used to empower a minority against the majority.
Mm-hmm.
Which I think if we were to look at a lot of laws through that lens of, is there a way that if the people who hold this opinion, who are in favor of this, ever became the minority, would they wield undue power against the majority? Which, again, I don't actually think that matters because that's the major... But that's the major flaw with democracy is that we can all agree today on one thing that 50 years from now, only a handful of us who still think that way can then beat us over the head with that idea, you know. But if we were to think more critically about it, you know, that way, I think, or maybe even put something in place to help with that, that I think would have to be one of the biggest bastions against making decisions like this. And I think that's why freedom of speech is so important, is because people change, minds change, ideas change, and freedom of speech allows for the society to change with the times, whereas restrictions on speech allow minorities of the past to wield power over the majorities of today.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and I think there's a great example to look at, like laws that were in place, you know, during like the Jim Crow era in the United States, where laws that were created by the majority at one time, the majority of the voting base at one time, quickly became super, you know, dominating to areas in which they were no longer the majority. Maybe South Africa apartheid is a better way to look at it, but that was just kind of a messy situation from the get go. because there are places in the United States where the African-American or the black population became the majority. You know, you could find places and areas where they became majorities in certain areas where they were still being oppressed by the minority of whites in their area.
Mm-hmm.
All because at the time when the whites were majority voters, they put in laws in place that would always favor them, regardless mm-hmm. of whether they were majority or minority status, you know. And I think most people look, if you give them, for some reason, if you give them that example, it's obvious. You know, maybe it's just taking advantage of the same kind of guilt-strickenness that we have in the West about things and ways that our people, air quotes, have treated their people, air quotes, even though we are not our people now as we were then, and they are not their people as
those people
were
are
now.
All dead. Yeah.
But, you know, sins of the father and such seems to be some, for some reason, a very powerful motivator for most groups of people for some reason, but I guess that's just culture for you because it gets passed down. And so you kind of identify with it as opposed to just your life, you mm-hmm. know? But yeah, I think making an argument like that against things like this make more sense. And maybe it would appeal more to people who don't just already share my opinions about secularism. Because anybody who has an opinion that favors secularism already would agree with me that, well, yeah, this is obviously a bad idea. Not because we hate your religion, even though we might. That's literally not why. Because I'm just treating your religion like every other religion, whereas you want to make your religion more important than
all the other ones. Or not even like every other religion. I'm treating your religion like any other idea.
Exactly. Actually, no, that's exactly
what
it is.
That's the thing, is that religions want to establish themselves as first-class ideas that can't be challenged.
That's true. And God forbid, no pun intended, that the religions actually stop fighting for 5 minutes and work together to agree that, look, if you will agree with me that religion is important, even though I, when I say that as a Christian, mean that Christianity is important.
Right, I mean Jesus is important.
And when you say that as a Muslim, that Muhammad is important, if we can just take a minute to agree that, yeah, we both think our ideas are really cool and all these secularists are the worst.
We can find a common enemy and stomp them out. Yeah.
Yeah. And that's terrifying. And I think that, not Christopher Hitchens, who was it? Selfish Gene.
Richard Dawkins.
Richard Dawkins talked about this in some of his talks, where that is the actual thing we should fear. The non-religious should fear religions,
because they might finally get over their bickering and unite.
And at that point,
it's over.
It's over. Yeah,
we're back into the dark ages.
We're back into the dark ages, exactly. And that's terrifying. And I don't know. I feel to some degree that this is somewhat happening. I don't know about you, but I have this. By the way, all of this is anecdotal in true philosopher's fashion. But like, you know, I get the sense that there's a big cultural movement to return to conservatism by the young, which is odd, but mm-hmm. it's not conservatism. Actually, they want to skip a generation and go backwards. They want to have their grandparents' lives, not their parents, you know. And their grandparents were really religious,
mm-hmm.
but because they don't have the lived experience and the same kind of hatred that came with that, they see all religions as better, you know. Reject modernity, embrace tradition. But they mean that. They don't mean my tradition, they mean tradition in general. So they view things like religion as important. They don't actually view their religion as important. They just view that having a religion is important.
Mm-hmm.
And that's weird to me to see happening. And it's because I think a lot of these, you know, young people are stumbling around in the dark searching for some kind of meaning in a world that is more and it is becoming more and more obvious how little important you as an individual are. Right. Because
right.
Whereas before, you could actually, it was very, very attainable for you to work really hard and become like the best X in your town. That was doable. You know, like, oh, my team made state football. Good for you. And mm-hmm. there are plenty of people who are down at the local bar drinking themselves to death, reliving their glory days. That in a time when that was doable. But now, because we have such a global lens, thanks to the internet, it's so easy to feel both nihilistic and that you truly don't matter, which, spoiler alert,
you don't. But that's okay.
But that's the problem. Instead of taking the it's okay pill of nihilism and just being happy for the reasons you want to be happy and doing the things you want to do.
Religion is here to prey on these people.
Exactly. Well, not religion. Tradition is here to prey on these people.
Mm.
In the way I see it.
Really?
Yeah, because I don't mean one particular religion. It's tradition in general. It's, oh, I want to live in a single income household again. I want to have a house, a small house with a dog in the country. I want a homestead for some reason. I want to pretend like I'm living Little House on the Prairie, but I got 5G freaking Wi-Fi in the house, you know? Like, and don't get me wrong, I get the appeal, right? I get the appeal of living in the country with good Wi-Fi. But at the same time, I'm not going to sit here and pretend like the advancements that have been made over the last just 20 years didn't happen.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? And LARP. That's, I think, what it is. It's a LARP. Because the moment you actually held any of these people's feet to the fire about, you really want to go back in time, they curl up, you know? But it's so easy to say things like that. It's so, in reality, that's, I think.
Well, and also these people never actually lived through that. So they're looking through everything with rose tinted glasses.
Exactly. Exactly. And man, it's terrifying. Like I'm going to make a claim that I can't substantiate, but the only other time in history, which by the way, I did not live in, that I can see some similarities to was early 20th century, rise of the weird political ideologies.
Mm.
Like if you look at the Wehrmacht Republic, that was a group of bunch of people looking at the way their grandparents had it and wanting it different. Same thing in the pre-USSR. You know, wouldn't it be great if we lived in a glorious Russian Empire again, or had the life that the people of the empire had? No, I don't want empire. You know, the Wehrmacht Republic didn't want Imperial Germany again, but they wanted to be important again. They wanted to be a part of a people. They wanted to be a part of a nation, of a brotherhood or a fatherland or a motherland. And before you know it, you have socialism, national or otherwise. And that's where it, to me, it's like terrifying. And I don't want to sit here and Peterson myself all over the place, but I do think he's kind of right about this as a potential thing to fear. Now he does it in like way more words than I said here that are needless, but I think he has a point. And seeing people's tolerance back to religion is a weird way, I think, is a symptom of that. Because neither of these things were really all that secular, but they provided some other vessel of meaning. And both of those things were born out of a severe bout of nihilism in a populace that just wasn't prepared to, which I get. Nihilism is a very hard pill to swallow. It is. I don't think it's necessarily natural that human beings want to see themselves as a cog or something like that, which I think is how most people imagine it is to be nihilistic. It's like, oh, I'm just a cog. I'm just a speck of dust in an infinite universe. Like, well, yeah, but you're also you to you, you know? And, yeah, I don't know. Like it, I think if it goes, right? Like if these things go, like you said, it's a point of no return and we're not going to come back from it.
Well, I say no return. It's a point of slow return.
We
did dig ourselves out of the dark ages too. But how long did that take?
More than centuries. One lifetime. Yeah.
Yeah. It's bad.
It is bad. Like it, and I don't know. I want to be sitting here being a doomer about it. Like we had an episode on the stack, which I guess we can go ahead and take off now, where we were going to discuss like what things were happening at the fall of the Roman Republic, which led to now, which by the way, the Roman Republic was very different than the way things are now. Just totally different. But I think the big thing we wanted to discuss with that is that it is not the first time in human history. It's just the last time it happened where we had made significant advancements that we actually just went backwards from.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you could point to other things like the Baghdad House of Wisdom and the height of the Islamic Golden Age.
Yep.
All the golden ages, right? There was the Hindu Golden Age. There's the Islamic Golden Age. Arguably,
like how we remember all these golden ages, but then we don't actually go about implementing them and doing the things that they were doing.
Or even, we talk about the golden age. We rarely talk about their collapses.
Right.
Like, I think the only collapse that I remember ever being educated about was the Bronze Age collapse, which had nothing to do, really, with their politics. That was just a confluence of wacky events that just led to a slight backslide compared to the dark ages that followed these golden ages, you know. And, yeah, it's very troubling.
Well, yeah, I mean, and also, yeah, let's talk about Dark Ages. By the way, there's not just one Dark Age. Arguably, the Middle East is in its Dark Age now.
Yeah, right? It never left.
Right, yeah. It there was the Islamic Golden Age, and it backslid into a Dark Age that is still happening today.
Yeah. Yeah,
and that's where we could be if we're not wise about this.
Yeah. And I don't know. I also, like, I guess while we're on this tangent, I hate this mentality of things are cyclical, man. You got to go through a gold age. You got to go. No, why?
No,
why?
You don't, actually. We're stupid and keep doing it, but we don't have to.
Yes.
You know what actual wisdom is? Learning from somebody else's mistakes. It is a thing that we can do. It's just not, it's not easy. It is natural for us to go in cycles, but it's also natural for us to die of losing our teeth. You know, like, just because things are natural doesn't mean we're bound to do them.
I'm just looking through the list of the Golden Ages.
Mm.
The greatest hits of humanity, if you will.
The highlight reel.
The highlight reel. The interesting one that stuck out to me was the Jewish Golden Age. Do you know when that was?
No.
It's when the Muslims ruled Spain.
Oh, I'm... Okay, I didn't know it was called that. I'm actually reading a book about that right now.
Oh, really?
Yes. Well, it's not really about that, but it involves a philosopher that emerged from that.
It's not Candide, is it?
No, it's not Candide.
Which, by the way, that's mentioned in that book too, but yeah. Apparently the Christian Golden Age, which I think they're living in it, honestly, even though... You know, yeah, they wouldn't say so.
Arguably, yeah.
Was the reference to the secession of kingdoms in Nebuchadnezzar's dream in Daniel II.
Hmm.
In decreasing order, identifies gold, silver, bronze, iron, finally mixed iron and clay. Like, oh, it's just a reference to a dream of the Christian Golden Age, which, again, arguably, hear ye Christians.
This is the Golden Age.
Stop crying about your persecution. You're living in your Golden Age.
Right.
You know,
don't waste it.
Don't waste it. Live it up. Go ask your Hindu or Muslim not friends that you have about theirs. They probably don't even know it. Yeah, it's just, man. I wonder, would you say that there's been a secular human age yet? Secular golden age, I should say. Or are we on the cusp of it? And if we keep going, we might get there at some point. Is there an argument to be made that would be the last golden age when it comes to religion, maybe? Potentially?
Mm. That seems kind of bold to claim.
Definitely.
I don't know if I'd say that. There is a path for that, but I think there's a path for that with any religion. I think the last one would be whichever one is the global one, right?
Yeah.
If that is even possible. But I don't think it is. So, no, I don't think there has been... I think maybe the closest thing that there has been to a secular golden age is the Enlightenment.
Yeah, that's a good point.
Like the emergence of secularism and the prosperity that came from that.
Yeah. So, if that's the argument, then we are living in it still. Because we're still technically living in the age of Enlightenment.
Mm-hmm.
Because we're living in countries that were informed by the Enlightenment. The fact
right,
that
America is founded on Enlightenment values, yeah.
Right. Well, and a lot of the countries that have democracies the way they do now are downstream from those Enlightenment mm-hmm. values, even though they still have carrying their baggage of monarchies and other, you know.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah, that's interesting. I think it's hard to look back and see, like, how would humans see us 1,000 years from now, but I do think there's going to be a considerable footnote about, like, I don't know how they'll view, like, it may be a bold claim, but if they were to say that this was the secular golden age, I would hope they would point to the fact that a country like the United States prospered as much as it did with its...
With the First Amendment. Yeah,
yeah, with the Enlightenment values that were in it,
yeah.
You know. And then for other countries, they would talk about how secularism culturally was allowed to flourish and the rest of the world benefited, even though some of the biggest wars were fought later on from that time, you know,
mm-hmm.
Which, I mean, that's, I guess, if you're looking at things cyclically, if you look at like the downfall of a lot of these golden ages, wars were kind of a part of it. because it allowed despots to arise, because during a war, having a singular leader makes a lot of sense. Mm-hmm. That's why most battlefields don't have like two generals in command of the whole army.
No, you need someone who makes a decision. Yeah.
Right. Which I think is a good secondary reason to strive for peace. Obviously, the first best reason is people dying is wrong.
Right. Death and destruction.
Death
is something that we would like to avoid.
Yeah. Yeah. It bad. But a good secondary reason would be that, you know, hey, man, don't harp on my golden age.
Mm-hmm.
Will you? This went all over the place. And I'm okay with it.
I'm also okay with it.
I guess the biggest thing about all of this is just, how do we get over that politeness of, like, because I feel like it's a common trait of secularism is apathy, because you kind of have to be apathetic to religion to be tolerant of it in mm-hmm. a secular society. And most secularism doesn't want hatred.
Well, yeah.
You know, because hatred is something that is usually applied to religions, mm-hmm. not hatred of themselves, although Christians, yes, you, that you see yourselves, but hatred towards other group, right?
Mm-hmm.
Do you think it would be like repeating the mistakes of the past for secularism to adopt a hateful attitude towards religion? Or do you think one of its strengths is its tolerance and lack of hatred and apathy towards religion?
I think the tolerance is the main feature. Yes, and I think that's its strongest arguing point as well, is like, no, we're not going to treat you special just because you're a religion. And we don't have to, in either direction, right? We don't have to give you first class status, but we also don't have to hate you and discriminate against you for being religious either. It's like, no, your religion is an idea that is on equal footing with every other idea, and you don't get to have any privileged status, and we can embrace that.
Yeah. What's weird, though, is I feel like by embracing that, you would get less hurt feelings from the religious as well. So, like, if I was thinking about it like this, say, for example, we had a secular third host on the show who came up to us and was like, hey, I would like to host a Bible burning. Would you guys be interested in exercising your First Amendment rights with me?
Mm-hmm.
How would you feel about that?
I mean, I'd probably do it.
Why?
Well, exercising my First Amendment rights is a fun pastime.
It is.
I think fire is also a fun pastime.
That's also true. As a human, I can attest, fire be lit. You're welcome.
It is taking a lot of effort for me not to just get up right now.
See, I'm on the fence about it, to be honest. Not because I think that it's morally wrong, because I don't.
Mm-hmm.
I think I would not stop you by any means. I would maybe even encourage you. But I feel like one of the benefits of secularism is, like, I think the biggest way to diffuse religious tension is to just care about them so little that it's not even worth it. But in a weird way, I also don't want to kowtow to the fear, because I'm not afraid.
Yeah, I think that's the biggest thing is like, okay, so I think everyone who, okay, maybe not everyone, but almost everyone who leaves religion goes through a phase of anger. There's
sure.
You probably go through all the stages of grief, actually. I should think about that myself at some point. That might be an interesting activity for myself. Anyway, so anger is one of the stages. And I think that would be like the prime time to lash out and do harsh things like burn symbols of your former religion. And I'm well past that stage now, right? I'm not like, I don't have any pent up anger anymore. I have Bibles at home and I don't look at them and think about burning them.
Sure.
But at the same time, yeah, I think it is also, if someone invited me to go do it, it's like, sure. As maybe even as a demonstration of myself that I really don't care about this anymore. It's like, yeah, I have no more reverence for this symbol. and am happy to express that.
Right. I think the point I was trying to make is that would it matter if they were saying, I'm going to go down to the local park and do it versus go to a campsite and burn them? Do you see that as any different?
I would actually rather do it at the park. Like, if we're going to do the First Amendment thing, let's do the First Amendment thing.
Yeah. I think I feel the same way about it that I feel about auditors.
First Amendment auditors.
Yep. Because that's literally what this is, by the way. It's just not what you normally think of. I'm okay with it. I do worry about how I don't care about the symbol. I worry that it's going to fan flames of people who say that this is why we need the blasphemy laws in the first place. Yeah. And I do think that there is a critical mass point where it's kind of a catch 22. If you don't need blasphemy laws, if no one offends the religion, we don't need blasphemy laws.
Yeah.
But if everyone's okay with it, no one would need to do it. Like, if everyone's okay with you burning Bibles, you wouldn't need to go burn them.
Right. Yeah. The point of doing it is to express an opinion, but also to challenge society. Yeah.
I just don't think that we got here by burning Bibles.
No, we didn't.
And I don't know how much burning the Bible forwards the goal of secularism. That's why I'm on the fence about it.
Mm-hmm.
I agree with it 100%. I would defend it to the death. But when it comes to whether or not I would go participate and do it, in the grander scheme of trying to protect and further the goals of secularism, I don't know. I feel like religion died in debate, not in demonstration.
You're right.
And so I would much, much rather go sit and watch Hitch Slaps all day.
That would probably be more fun than burning a Bible, yes.
So, I don't know. It's a weird thing, because I am genuinely on the fence about it. You know, maybe I would. Because I've never actually gone to it.
I was going to say, it's also just an experience that I've never had before, so...
That's true.
I might try that out.
Yeah. And I wish that optics weren't so important, but that literally is everything in a democracy, is how people take it or how you communicate it. So, I do think it would be an interesting, worthwhile experience to try to organize one, just to see, you know, how much trouble we would get in. If I wanted that smoke.
Okay, here's a fun hypothetical question to close us off with for this thought.
Okay.
Which would be more provocative, a Bible burning or a flag burning?
Is it rhetorical?
I don't know.
Find out next week.
Find out next week when we burn things.
On Philosophers.
Philosophers.
If you like the music in this episode, please check out Jippy on Bandcamp at jippy.bandcamp.com.
Philosophers is supported by viewers like you.
If there's a topic you'd like us to discuss,
or a topic you'd like to see revisited in the future,
please let us know by contacting us using the methods in the description,
or in the comments below. Thank you for listening.